Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, where Danny is not allowed to participate because he is under a 60% free throw shooter, and rival podcast decided to follow him repeatedly until I just took him off the podcast. But Anna actually is here. We're going to give it a shot. Hopefully you're not going to get hacked. Danny, how are you doing, man?
I'm thankful that we're recording this during Rockets Clippers so I don't have to watch the end of it.
Yeah, for those who wonder, we did in fact subject ourselves to the first 3.5 quarters or so, but finally when Doc called for mercy and put in his subs, we decided to start recording. Let's talk about an actual basketball game that occurred before Rockets Clippers, the free throw shooting contest. And that is, of course, Bulls-Cavaliers. Relatively handy Cleveland victory, despite the fact that the Bulls came back at the end. What went right for the Cavs? What went wrong for the Bulls in this game?
Well, it was kind of, I wouldn't say the word funny, it was interesting that when Taj Gibson was ejected, which I feel was a poor decision, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, it kind of felt like, oh yeah, the Cavs are up 10, we're going to go that. But then the Bulls ended up making it close. And so while I don't want to make that the story of this game, it certainly was a major factor in it.
Well, it was, especially because Noah has just continued to be ineffective in essentially every facet of the game at this point. I mean, there was some hope that he would at least be one of the better defensive options. But even at the rim, the Cavs were just scoring over him left and right at the basket. Really wasn't able to make his presence felt there. On the defensive glass, he gave up a critical rebound at the end, helped by a missed box out by Kirk Heinrich. And really, it was just – that was the biggest thing I took away from this, even more than – the fact that LeBron had an awesome game, the fact that Derrick Rose started so well and then appeared to aggravate his shoulder injury is just that with Noah out there, it somehow is worse even than we thought it was during the regular season with him.
Yeah, and I wrote a tweet during the game that when I watch this team, and I completely believe this, that when I watch this team, I still see a really good season for them next year. And a lot of that is related to health. And it was surprising to me. Granted, I don't get much of Bulls Twitter, that we don't cross streams very often. We're talking about, you know, like, oh, we can't defend like this. And my first thought with that was, you don't defend like this when Joakim Noah is healthy. You know, like, you're not dealing with a representative sample here. And I don't worry it that much about Chicago's long-term defense.
I do, because if Noah's not going to be any good, then and the offense is so bad when he's out there, you know, maybe he could bounce back next year. Maybe there's a whole other injury he's been dealing with. To me, it's not even so much the fact that his legs are bad, but, like, something seems to have happened to his hands. Like, yeah. He has really a ton of difficulty corralling the ball. It's really weird because even when he passes or when he'll go up for layups off of 2 feet, he almost tries to pass or shoot a 2 foot layup in like that same kind of tornado motion. And also just even when he's doing his 1 foot runners, trying to finish with one hand, he's really struggling to do that. The ball just always seems to slip out of his hands. It's really weird. I don't know what happened to him there. And you wouldn't think that the knee issue would be so much of a problem there, but, you know, maybe it is, or maybe he has some other issue that we don't know about and we'll find out about in the offseason. But really, it's just, it's tough for the Bulls. And then without Taj Gibson out there, with Mirotić, who obviously had champion, playing a terrible game, you know, the Bulls probably did miss Gasol in this game. You know, and my concern with him was always more how he was going to be used, not that he's ineffective, although he's not a great defensive player. I don't think that he would have been much worse than Noah was in this game. So, yeah, they certainly could have used him tonight. And it appears, at least for one night, that the idea that they would be better off without him may not have been correct.
Yeah, and something that also shouldn't be obscured, we talked about a little bit, is LeBron had a really great game today. And it was something that you and I have talked about, is that he's been relatively inefficient. And tonight was one of those nights that he has sometimes. So he had 38 points, 24 shots, but he also had 9 of 12 from the line, 6 assists, and no turnovers. And the no turnovers is pretty remarkable.
Massive. Yeah. That, I mean, when you consider that he was really, I think, had been at 5 or more in every game of this series, or at least 3 of the 4, to be at 0 turnovers, that was huge. And he really got, in that spectacular first half when he had 24 points, he was getting to the basket at will. Butler's foul trouble was a big issue for him being able to get into him as physically. And then the Bulls' help really was inadequate. Part of that was because the Cleveland role players were hitting their shots. Shumpert, Kyrie got back on track. He had 25 points in this game, even though still not, he wasn't quite right. 3 of 6 on threes for him. Smith also is always a threat. So the Bulls weren't able to, unless Mozgov was in the game, they weren't able to get enough help at the rim on LeBron. He was able to either back in or just drive in with very little resistance. So good job by him. I didn't see a ton of adjustment from the Cavs. They moved the ball a little bit better than they had been before, but still only 19 assists.
And Kyrie was closer to 100%, which I think was a big deal for them as well, because he was so much more of a threat out there.
Yeah, and the Bulls, I think, really blew it in Game 4 when he was just so hobbled, when they really had no one else except LeBron. The Bulls just couldn't get quite enough scoring in that Game 4. And one thing that really has struck me about this Bulls team, and one reason that I think maybe moving on from Thibodeau might be useful, at least a data point in favor of that, is this is a team that should be fast-breaking left and right against the Cavs. And instead, there's so many possessions where the first action or the first pass doesn't occur until there's 12 left on the shot clock. So it's really, with a team that has guys like Rose, Butler, Dunleavy even is someone who can still run the floor well even at his age. Mirotić is a guy who should be a good transition player. It would be nice to see them push the ball more, and really they just have nothing on fast break points this entire series, unless they just get like an easy steal and a pick six in the backcourt.
And that fact is also something that does not bode well for a potential spot for Thibodeau in New Orleans, because I think you and I are both on board with New Orleans being a team that should run all the time and run a lot, especially if they're playing Anthony Davis at center, which they will presumably for stretches, though I don't think he'll start there. And you want to start actions a lot quicker than 12 seconds left in the shot clock if you have Anthony Davis on your team.
So what else can we take away from this game? I mean, what did you think of the Gibson-Noah, or I'm sorry, the Gibson-Dellavedova kerfuffle that led to Gibson's ejection?
The leg lock was definitely there, and I mean, it did its job. I wish that they had punished Dellavedova in some way. And part of the challenge with it is just the idea of, you know, flagrant one, flagrant two, because it wasn't really a part of the play. So I understand why they were drawn to that, but the severity of it just wasn't there to do that. He should not have been removed from the game. And the disparity between the punishments was something that bothered me. I don't know if it affected the outcome, but I wasn't comfortable with how it turned out.
I'll say this. I tweeted as soon as I saw it live that Gibson was going to get thrown out. And then when you see the replay, you saw what Dellavedova did, grabbing his foot, really just a dirty, irritating, annoying play, no place for it in a game, really. Certainly should be technical foul worthy. And Taj didn't really do anything. I don't think he even really made contact with him much, if at all, when he tried to free his leg. It just that his foot happened to come forward and it looked like he was trying to kick him in real time. So that's why they have replay. But you know, I mean, I don't think there is a single neutral observer who agreed with that result. So why even look at the replay then? I'd be very interested to see what the explanation is there from the league. But again, I don't think that's why the Bulls lost. They were lucky really to even get back into it. Part of the reason they did was because Cleveland went back to the all LeBron ISO all the time offense, but they still were able to get just enough out of it. Jimmy Butler, awesome fourth quarter for him. His three-point shooting was on point in the fourth quarter, though he did take a really tough shot that when they were down two with about 38 seconds left or so that could have taken the lead, but he came off the screen and was just fading away. Outside of that, though, really nice performance from him, 29 points on only 18 shots. 22 shooting possessions. So he was fantastic. Derrick Rose, though, was dominant in the first quarter, and then he re-injures his shoulder and didn't basically make a shot after that.
Yeah, I definitely think that was a factor. Well, of course, we'll talk about it once the series is set. I think it's kind of fun to talk about it now, considering what's happened with both teams. How does what has happened in this round affect what a lot of us thought was going to be the conference finals in the first place, which would be Cavs-Hawks?
Yeah, it's certainly looking like it's going to be that way now. Although, your Bulls and 7 pick, are you abandoning your Bulls and 7 pick after this game? Isn't this pretty much what you predicted was going to happen?
Yeah, it is what I predicted. After Game 3, I predicted the Cavs would win games 4 and 5 and then would lose 6 and 7. Rose's injury definitely scares me a little bit. And also, that the Bulls lost, the way they lost Game 4 was really kind of, I guess you could use the word dispiriting in that sense. Like, was that Game 3? No, it was Game 4. But Kyrie was so hobbled. And
yeah,
that was kind of one of those moments where, like, oh, I'm not, I felt less confident that they could do this double. I guess I will walk away from it, but I still think that this series is still there for the taking for Chicago.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's, the Game 5 winner, I think, goes on to win about 83% of the time. But I do think the Bulls are slight favorites to at least get it back to a Game 7. But if Kyrie is going to be effective again, I think the advantage really shifts to Cleveland. With his injury was one of the reasons that I had a lot more confidence in the Bulls. You didn't see him scoring 25 points on 16 shots by any means in this game. This is a very efficient performance from the Cavs in what was a glacially slow game to put up 106 points. So with that being the case, I think that the Cavs certainly have the advantage. They may even close it out in Game 6. We'll have to see. I mean, the Bulls just have to get a better performance from their bench guys, all of whom were just horrendous in this game.
Yeah. Do you want to move on to the other game?
No, well, a couple more notes first.
Okay.
One was that the Bulls had a lot of success attacking Kyrie, especially in the third quarter when they were able to kind of get back into it for a time. First half of the third quarter where Dunleavy actually was posting up Kyrie, coming off screens, really was able to attack him very well. But then when the Bulls matched down to go small, for most of the fourth quarter, which admittedly with Gibson out, Mirotić playing terribly, they might have felt like they had to do, that gave Kyrie a hiding place on Heinrich. And Heinrich, of course, did absolutely nothing in this game, basically made one corner three and that was it. I would have liked to have seen them go with Snell there instead, someone who could make Kyrie work a little more, or at least, like, shoot over him on the perimeter. But, Tibbs had to go with Heinrich again. And, that's about it. I mean, it's a dispiriting loss for the Bulls. They made a heroic comeback. Did we talk about that LeBron James block on Derrick Rose's tying layup? That's something that certainly has to be talked about.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. And it was one, I don't know if you felt the same way that I did. I saw it coming from a long way away. And the other huge factor that led to that happening, I believe, was Dellavedova slowed Rose down enough to make it that it was more feasible for LeBron to get there. And it was remarkable.
Yeah, he really, we'll get on LeBron for not expending enough energy sometimes. He, like, busted his butt down the floor to make that block. Another guy we got to talk about, too, in 42 minutes, Iman Shumpert, 6 out of 10 from the field, 13 points in that second quarter. He was killing the Bulls on at first and second quarter on, like, really tough pull-ups. He's actually, Synergy tweeted out that he's 8 of 13 on pull-up jump shots, which has never really been his forte. So he is looking much better after his groin injury. He did a good job on Rose in the second half, although it looked like Rose was limited by injury as well. So Shumpert was another guy who was limited over the weekend in those games. And now with he and Irving looking a lot better, you have to really like the Cavs moving forward.
Yeah, definitely agree.
One more thing, Mirotić would really, really struggle in this game. Minus 23, worst on either team after he had the best plus minus on either team in the last two games. The Cavs really were able to neutralize him by putting a small guy on him, especially when it was LeBron. Mirotić has no chance against LeBron. He just doesn't have that kind of physical force. And he got taken advantage of defensively quite a bit. He had been pretty good defensively in the first couple of games since Gasol's injury, but definitely wasn't in this game, and you know, wasn't out there at the end and didn't deserve to be, unfortunately. I was hoping for more from him. It may be that he just had a bad game, or that he isn't healthy still from the Bucks series, his injury there, which actually looked like a pretty nasty injury. It wouldn't surprise me if he's nowhere near 100% right now. But certainly was not the panacea that you or I had hoped, or Bradford Doolittle, who wrote a great piece, which ended up being, at least for this game, totally wrong at ESPN today, too, advocating the same thing.
Yeah. And I think that something you and I have talked about is kind of a theme of this playoffs is the ability in certain matchups to play a wing on a stretch four. We talked about it with the Warriors and Ryan Anderson, and it at this point in his career, it could be that Mirotić just falls into that group. Of course, LeBron is also LeBron, so that is different. But
yeah,
I think that, I mean, thinking of LeBron as a wing is doing him a little bit of disservice, considering he's built like Karl Malone, but just fast like a wing.
Yeah, no, I mean, Mirotić can be effective posting up a lot of wings, but LeBron is not one of those guys. All right, I mean, do we really, we need to get to this Houston Clippers game?
Need is a strong word.
I think we don't have much choice. You know, this is an NBA podcast after all, this is a playoff game. What'd you think here? Has Houston found anything after this, or is this just kind of, all right, game five, dead cat bounce type of thing?
I don't think it was a dead cat bounce. I think this was more of a James Harden game that we expected to see, especially considering the Clippers don't have a great natural defender for him. But the question is, if he can do that every night, then they can do that. My question for you is, what do you think about the switch from Terrence Jones starting to Josh Smith? Do you think that was a factor in their success tonight?
I don't think it was that much. I think maybe that Smith is a little bit better defensively than Jones is, and so having Jones against the bench unit or of the Clippers works a little bit better. And he also, especially if he's going up against Hawes, can score. I mean, and he had a nice game scoring-wise in this game too, which he really hadn't before. So at least he started contributing offensively. I think a lot of it, though, the Clippers just missed a ton of wide-open threes.
Yep.
And I mean, that was the big difference. It was, I think, that Houston, quote-unquote, stopped the Clippers, but I think the Clippers were still getting pretty good shots. I wouldn't say that Houston's defense looked that much better to me, but what do you think?
But wasn't that a part of the story with Houston's defense this year, was that they were doing really well in defense, but part of the story was that the opponents were shooting an unsustainably low percentage from three?
Yeah, no, maybe it is. I mean, and the Clippers were 9 out of 35 on threes, and at one point they were like 6 out of 27 during the competitive portion of the game. Redick was 1 out of 8. Crawford was 1 out of 5. Crawford contributed absolutely nothing else in the box score aside from 3 fouls and 5 points on 10 field goal attempts, so really rough game for him. Matt Barnes was 1 out of 8, 1 out of 4 on threes for 5 points. So really those role guys did not succeed hardly at all. And Austin Rivers, he regressed as well, 3 out of 11. So, and he was 1 out of 5 on threes. So I think, you know, his shooting especially might have been due to regress, but guys like Crawford, Redick, even Barnes is a good three-point shooter. They're not going to shoot that badly. And it's not like those guys were taking horrible shots either.
Yeah, and I think this was a good example of kind of the best case, worst case for either one of these teams, and except that Blake Griffin had a good game and Chris Paul did all right. And, you know, that is the nature of the series. It didn't give me that much more confidence, though it did give me some, because I thought the Rockets looked so bad in Game 4 that I think the line that I used was, whether it's 5 or whether it's 6, it's over. I'm not as definitive now, but not that much less definitive. I mean, I thought they played better tonight than they have in the other games, but the Clippers, to me, are still the overwhelming favorite to win this series.
I mean, the Rockets did put up a .124 on these guys. It was another fast-paced, quote-unquote, game. At least there are a lot of possessions, in part due to the fact that there are so many fouls. And you know what? I think in protest to the fact that there's all this, I think the league needs to change the rule. We talked about that. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, I think they need to change it. There are a couple of different ideas that I support, but the biggest general concept is if something isn't a basketball play, then punish that. Punish that kind of stuff more than you punish everything else.
Yeah, I was on the fence before this playoffs, and now that I've worn an enormous hole in my drywall from banging my head against the wall as watching these free throws in these last two Clipper series, I'm ready for the league to just move on. It's a sideshow. It's boring. Whatever man up kind of arguments you want to come up with, or, you know, evening the playing field from big guys and little guys or whatever, it's just not worth it. I'm done. Yeah. Let's move on.
And it's an entertainment property. I mean, people think about sports as a lot of different things, but to a degree, it's competing in terms of viewers and everything else with entertainment. And there are very few other endeavors where they actively make things less enjoyable for the people in person and on television, just for whatever reason.
All right. Well, so, I mean, I still think the Clippers probably roll in game six, but yeah. it is kind of quote unquote nice to be the home team when you come back, when you're trying to come back from 3-1 down. Because you think about it, all right, you know, we're at home, we can win game five, it's 3-2. And then, you know, we got to steal one on the road. And if we can do that, now we have a game seven at home. So, you know, you can kind of talk your way into finding a way to get there. Whereas if you're the road team down 3-1 and you're going back to game five, the other team's place, like you're basically just thinking there's no way we're winning this. So, I mean, at least you can kind of keep the morale up, and the Rockets deserve credit at the very least for defending a little bit better, not giving up on the series after those two totally dispiriting losses in LA. So we'll see what happens in the next game. I still expect the Clippers to go through, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Monty Williams firing?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think that's by far the most interesting news of the day. And, well, so I'll ask you first. Do you agree or disagree with this move?
I agree with it. I think that they're in a place where they can improve. I think Monty Williams, we've talked about the idea of positive, negative, neutral. Even though I've said some very, very mean things about his offense, and I stand by all of the very mean things I've said about his offense, I think that he's not a clear negative in that sense, but I feel really confident in saying that he's not a clear positive. And so to me, if you have a young team and you have a superstar, not in the making, a superstar in Anthony Davis, then you do that. And the other dynamic in this, and it's part of the reason why I was a little bit surprised that Oklahoma City made their hiring so early, is that I would say it's between New Orleans and theoretically Chicago if that job opens for the most desirable job. And I think that you can do a lot with that power, that if they're willing to be patient with it, if they're willing to go for it. And I think, you know, the two people that I thought of immediately were Alvin Gentry and Tom Thibodeau, though I also would be fascinated with D'Antoni for similar reasons to Gentry. But New Orleans has a huge piece now because there might be other jobs. We don't know exactly what's going to open up, but it's hard to think of something that would be more interesting for a coach than a team that barely made it into the playoffs this year, but should be a lot healthier next year. So you get the credit for the improved health, which coaches, that's always nice to get because that gives you a security buffer and a lot of talent.
So here's what I would put on the positive side of the ledger for Monty Williams. Number one, the development of Anthony Davis. He's way ahead of schedule. He's a guy, when he came out of Kentucky, that was only 3 years ago, that he was basically leading a team to the national championship, playing center, almost never took jump shots. Now he has like one of the best jump shots of any big man in the game. You know, really his entire offensive game has been great. He's gotten stronger. And it's not all Williams. A lot goes to just the player development staff there as well, but he certainly has done a great job of helping him develop. So that's number one in this ledger. Number two, I actually think that they have met or exceeded expectations offensively the last 2 years when you consider the guys who are out. And, you know, Ryan Anderson didn't play a lot of the year, was ineffective for a lot of the year as well. Drew Holiday missed a ton of time. Eric Gordon really took about half the year before he was able to round into form. He was working for the first half of the year or so with what was not an NBA quality bench. And so they still managed to finish ninth in offense this year, which I think is, if not right around where you think they would be given the talent on the roster, maybe even slightly above that. So that I think is in his corner. And then the last thing too, I think is despite the fact that their defense was really bad the last 2 years, given the defensive talent that they have on the team, I thought they actually did a really good job defending the Warriors in those first three games before they kind of ran out of gas in game four when they were about to get swept. But I thought he did well. He had a good strategy there, used Anthony Davis's talents extremely well, and really for much of those series, they flummoxed the Warriors offensively in a way that I did not think would be possible for a team that ranked 22nd in defense during the regular season. Unfortunately, they also ranked 22nd in defense during the regular season. Yeah. So, I mean, look at the defensive talent on this roster. Drew Holiday, granted, only played half the season, still a very good defender at point guard. AD, obviously, fantastic. Omer Asik has been one of the league's best rim protectors at center throughout his career until this year. So when you got those three guys out there, and then even someone like Evans or Gordon, like they're not absolute sieves.
And Pondexter too.
Yeah, they brought in Pondexter on midseason. He's solid. So with all that being the case, you really need to have a better defensive performance. I think that that's kind of low-hanging fruit for the next coach to come in, and you know, as long as they can maintain the offense, they could get, with the personnel on hand, they should be able to get this defense into the top 10, maybe even top 5, and with the shot blocking ability and the mobility of someone like Davis and Holiday as well at the point guard position.
If you were a coaching prospect, the hottest coaching prospect out there, and you were offered both the New Orleans and the Chicago jobs, which one would you be more interested in?
Whew, wow, that is a tough one. I think might depend to offer me more money. I think that is a tough call. You know, the Bulls do sort of have a history of churning through coaches. They also don't fire their coaches that often, though, despite the fact that they will end up having some conflict with them at times. I think you have a better front office in Chicago overall. I mean, look at the guys that they've drafted. Mirotić, Jimmy Butler, Taj Gibson, all guys who are drafted in the 20s or even the 30th pick, like Butler. So they've done a pretty good job in the draft. Good culture there. You're in the East, which really helps. You know, there still is not looking like there's going to be a dominant team in the East next year. Rose is looking like he could get back to being, if not a franchise guy, at least, you know, a higher tier starting point guard. Butler, Mirotić, those three guys I think are a real nice core going forward. The Pelicans, on the other hand, they have Davis, but they're also really limited cap-wise in who they can acquire going forward. So, and they're in the West, and there's a lot of great teams in the West that you have to get above. So I think really, In Chicago, I'd probably would go with Chicago ultimately over New Orleans. But I mean, the counter argument there is you have the talent on hand. If you can get the defense up to a top 10 level, then you got an easy 50-win team there too.
Yeah, and what's crazy is I said that I think Gentry would be a great fit for New Orleans. I think he'd be a good fit for Chicago too. So, you know, it could be that you're looking for some more guys, though obviously, as you said, a defensive minded person could be a nice fit for them. But I think those are the two glamour jobs now that OKC is booked.
Let's say this though, and we've alluded to this before, but how many of the teams in the last 5 years who have fired their coach regret it? I can think of one off the top of my head, and that's George Karl.
Yeah.
I mean, I think clearly he did a much better job than Brian Shaw did. Obviously, they had some personnel turnover in Denver as well. But that probably, it's hard to argue that moving on from him was the right move. But are there really any others in the last 5 years when you can say, oh man, the guy who came in was clearly worse than this guy? Even though you have a lot of situations in which winning coaches were fired. I mean, to give some examples.
What about the Lakers?
Okay, yeah, although.
but they have a lot of options.
I don't think they actually fired D'Antoni, though. I think he resigned and agreed to move on because they wouldn't extend his contract. So that's a little bit different. And I understand why they wouldn't extend his contract, actually. But I mean, aside from them, you've got, let's see. So who are some winning teams who fired the coaches? We've got the Grizzlies fired Lionel Hollins after a Western Conference Finals. I don't think anyone would argue that Dave Yeager has done a worse job than he has, maybe even a little better job, although they haven't gotten back to the finals yet. They kind of lucked into that because of the Russell Westbrook injury that year anyway, and then they got swept. Clippers moved on from Vinny Del Negro to Doc Rivers. Despite what you think about Doc Rivers, the GM, clearly an upgrade on the sidelines, no-brainer there. Who else got moved on from there first?
The Warriors.
Well, the Hawks
with Larry Drew to Budenholzer.
Yeah, that's true. Obviously the Warriors, too, is another one. So, I mean, these high-profile teams where you say, oh, we're making progress, we can't get rid of this guy. Well, I mean, you know internally what the guy's been doing. And if you look at that and then also just kind of the stats show that maybe he's not, you know, hasn't been making the most of the talent on the roster, whether it was Mark Jackson and the Warriors being 12th in offense last year with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, or whether it's Monty Williams and you got Omer Asik and Anthony Davis and you're 22nd in defense, maybe you look at that and say, all right, you know, at the very least, there's more upside than downside here. The only downside you can look at, though, is that perhaps Anthony Davis will be alienated now.
Yeah, but I mean, the chances, as much as somebody who wrote the piece advocating for him to take the qualifying offer, the chances that means anything in the immediate future are pretty low.
Yeah, I mean, all reports are they're going to offer him a maximum extension. He is not yet, at least by my reading of the rule, eligible for the Rose Rule, 30% max. He has to make either one more All-NBA team, assuming he makes one this year, which he seems almost guaranteed to, or be voted in as an All-Star starter one more time. He has to be one of those things again next year.
Or win the MVP.
Or win the MVP. Not completely far-fetched either, frankly. So if they'll probably write the contract where if he meets that criteria, he'll get his full 30%, which was not the case for Kyrie or for Paul George, some of the other maximum extensions we've seen. And really, it's difficult for someone when you're going to get that kind of life-changing money on a first contract to say we're not going to do that. That's not going to kick in also until 2016, so he'll get the benefit of the higher cap number as well that year. You know, it's not the sort of, even though he agrees to it this summer, the amount is not actually set until next summer. So it would be a big surprise if he turns down a maximum extension, even if he is annoyed with the fact that they moved on from the coach. And guess what? You know what? If you start winning and you start playing better, which I think is kind of the gambit here, then I think a lot of those concerns fall by the wayside, and that's where I think the Pelicans are going here.
Yeah, and two other small points on that is that it's a 2-year wait functionally because of the way that it works with the qualifying offer. It's a 2-year wait. You do get unrestricted free agency, and that's scary. And the other component of it is that when you think about the way that agents are paid and considering the uncertainty, I'm guessing that the financial people in his background, beyond the fact that it's his first big contract, would be very happy to have him secure that now and secure their portion of it as opposed to waiting and, you know, whatever happens, happens.
And another thing, too, is you lock that salary in before a potential work stoppage in the summer of 2017. Otherwise, you're going to end up, if you do take the qualifying offer, so basically he would have one more year next year on his rookie salary. Then he takes the qualifying offer, which is nowhere near as much as he could make on an extension. And then instead of, you know, getting to be a free agent right away, you have a potential work stoppage as well. This way you at least are getting paid in year one of that maximum extension before the potential work stoppage. And then if something happens to the salaries structure after that, you're at least locked in. You know, they're probably going to at least grandfather in the previous contracts. That's been the pattern. So I think still very likely he signs that maximum extension, and nobody's turned it down yet.
Yep. You want to do a few quick questions?
Yeah, we got like 5 more minutes here for a couple. You want to head some in mind?
Yes, I do. So the first one that I saw that I thought was interesting is from Bo Schwartz Madsen. It's B-O-S-C-H-W-E-R-T-Z. He asked, injuries now aside, who would you say is the fourth best point guard right now? And he said the top three is Stephen Curry, Chris Paul, and Russell Westbrook.
I would agree with that top three. Yep. Well, so who are some of the candidates? Let's think about it. Kyrie would be one.
John Wall. Damian Lillard.
Damian Lillard.
Kyle Lowry, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're definitely got the next tier is those three guys. Of Wall, Lillard, and Irving. I don't know who else you would have in that tier, frankly. I think I would go with Wall because he's someone who has to run the show. He's got a lot less offensive talent around him than Lillard and Irving do. Also a much, much better defensive player. So I think John Wall would probably be my pick there as the fourth best point guard in basketball.
Yeah, he would be mine too. And another big part of that, especially when you're comparing Wall and Irving, is that Wall has the primary ball handler responsibilities already and has done well with it. Kyrie is a very talented basketball player, but I think that that isn't necessarily his strength, as you know, being the catalyst for an offense. And so while that means that Irving could be maybe better in certain systems, and Cleveland's might be one of those, if you're talking in the abstract, I look for the more broadly applicable player over the less applicable player, as more of a deciding factor, because you can use him and he can have more success in a larger amount of situations.
Yeah, Kyrie just does not have great passing vision. I think that's very obvious. And the fact that he can be used now as, especially playing off LeBron, he's an excellent shooter. You know, and we shouldn't discount that because the Wall basically can't play off the ball at all. So Irving does have more versatility in that sense, but I think more teams just need a lead guard who can distribute. Wall is probably one of the top three best passers from the point guard position, and also, you know, an excellent defender, as we've talked about before, maybe the best shot-blocking point guard ever. So, yeah, Wall's my pick.
Yep. Do you want to? You have one in mind? I have a couple more.
Yeah. Go ahead. If you got one ready.
Sure. So one from Arturo Galletti, who's been on my podcast a few times. He said, "Gun to your head," pointing it to me, but to both of us, "what is your finals pick and your champion right now?"
That's good. I would much rather have that gun pointing at your head than me. I'll still answer the question. It's not. I don't need a gun to my head. Well, so since you apparently need to answer first to not face certain death, why don't we let you take the first crack here?
Sure. So we already talked about the East a little bit. I think that as much as I've lost a lot of confidence in Cleveland in terms of their viability as a championship team, I have lost a lot of faith in the Hawks as well, and I think that Cleveland could do a good job defending them. So I'm staying with Cleveland as the Eastern team, and right now my Western Conference champion and NBA champion is the Golden State Warriors.
Yep, I got the Warriors as well. I'm doing it. I'm going with the Hawks. I still think that Cleveland has some injury concerns. I think that Cleveland, while the Bulls have some offensive talent, I think that they do not put a lot of pressure on a team like Cleveland that really struggles to communicate defensively, and I think that Cleveland's rim protection, which has been a big problem with Thompson and Mozgov for the Bulls in this series, especially since they have a lot of guys who are not the greatest finishers at the rim, that is going to be neutralized by the Hawks shooting and ball movement. Kyrie is not going to have a place to hide in this series the way he's been able to on someone like Dunleavy or, you know, Heinrich when he's in the game. So, you know what? I think I'm going with the Hawks. They have the home court. I don't feel incredibly confident in that pick, but, that's my pick for right now. Atlanta, Golden State, with Golden State winning you know, probably in six games.
A small follow-up with that. Do you think there is much of a chance right now that we see an Eastern Conference NBA champion?
I don't know. I think I would actually give... Would you give the Hawks or Warriors a better... Or Hawks or Cavs a better shot against the Warriors?
I'd say without Love, I'd probably go the Hawks because they have a lot of offensive talent, and I think their ceiling is higher. LeBron and Kyrie obviously are phenomenal talents, and so you could see them if Kyrie can get back close to 100%, I could see it. But I think I guess the Hawks. I don't know. I don't have a firm grasp on which one of those teams. I don't think either one of them has a great chance, but I do think that when they play well, either one of them would have a respectable chance against the Clippers.
All right, let's see if we can find one more here. And this is a little simpler one. This is from Sam Kube, or Kube, I'm not sure which, S-A-M-K-U-B-E. Can you explain the process for calculating the number of non-fouling possessions remaining? And what this is referring to is a lot of times when I'm live tweeting a game, I'll kind of calculate how many possessions a team has left to really look at what the odds are of them coming back. And basically, a good rough shorthand is that teams average two offensive possessions per minute. So if you've got 5 minutes left in the game, you probably have about 10 possessions left unless you start fouling or you just get a ton of turnovers. But really, you know, maybe you might get it up to 12 or 13 there. But, you know, it gives you an idea of, all right, if we're down 10 with 5 minutes left, you feel like, all right, we're still in it. We still have a shot. But really... outscoring a team by a point per possession, you're basically, you better hold that team to maybe like two or three more buckets if you're down 10 and score really well yourself. So it's just kind of a way to think about it. Like, all right, how realistic is a comeback here? And what are you going to need to do to make that happen? And I think putting it in terms of possessions rather than minutes is a little bit better way to do that. And, you know, since teams usually average between, about, you know, 95 possessions or so, a good shorthand of just calculating it off the top of your head will be two possessions for every minute.
Yeah, it's definitely good to have out there because it provides context for something that I think is good to understand when you're thinking about the how much time is left in a game and, you know, when a game is truly over in that sense.
All right, well, we get our first... Dunked On podcast, hopefully from a Warriors home game since I was out of town for game two. So hopefully we will be coming to you relatively live as soon as the post-game festivities are over tomorrow from Oracle Arena when we'll wrap up game fives from both Golden State, Memphis, and Atlanta, Washington. Until then, you can follow both of us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through the Real GM page and give us a rating perhaps as well. That is always highly appreciated. So till next time, thanks a lot.